This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In some places, a lot of African countries, the state cannot even deliver justice. People have to go to self-help measures. They have to rely on, you know, other actors to give them justice, to provide public services, to give them a sense of identity.
That's senior professorial lecturer and chair at the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University, Professor Kwaku Nuama, talking about ethnic divisions, clan mentality, and paramilitary force formations in Africa. Details coming up also. Police in Kenya fire tear gas to break up protests over tax hikes. And violent vigilantism has erupted in Tunisia after three migrants were accused of killing a Tunisian national. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story following the death of a Tunisian in Sfax, allegedly at the hands of three migrants. Violent vigilantism has erupted. Citizens have rounded up black people and hundreds have tried to flee the city. Migrant advocacy groups say at least 500 sub-Saharan people have been expelled from the country to the Libyan border. Reporter Elysia Volkman has more from Tunis.
Racial tensions in the city of Sfax on the southern coast of Tunisia continue to boil after violent clashes on Monday, where a Tunisian man was killed. Vigilante violence has caused a panic amongst the sub-Saharan community, causing many to flee the city. Tensions were further inflamed when the Minister of Health alleged on national radio that migrants are infected with tuberculosis. A member of parliament from Sfax, Tariq Mahdi, told Voice of America that for the moment, calm is returning to the city. Tunisia has become a major departure point for migrants seeking to get to Europe. Since the conflict in Sudan began in April, the number of Sudanese people crossing into Tunisia has increased, and many have congregated in Sfax trying to contact people smugglers to get on a boat to Italy. A local activist and online influencer, Ziad Malouli, earlier organised a demonstration to demand that the government better manage the large influx of migrants into Sfax. Ziad says he's anti-racism, but since the civil war in Sudan, there has been a massive influx of migrants, mainly Sudanese, into Sfax. He says, unlike now, there was always a community of illegal migrants. They worked and people got along fine. He says he used to run cultural programs with the migrant community. However, since the new wave of refugees and migrants, he says crime has increased and people are afraid. But he also condemns the police roundups and the vigilante activities. The government has remained largely silent. Voice of America has sent questions to the Minister of Interior to ask why it is forcibly expelling people without judicial process, but as yet has received no reply. On Tuesday, President Kais Saied reiterated his opposition to migration. He also said Tunisia will not guard the borders of other countries. However, he has offered no solution to the unrest, nor for those expelled into Libya. Bekan, a Cote d'Ivoirian, had been working as a waiter in a high-class restaurant before his arrest.
La situation est très critique. Il y a pas d'eau à boire, il y a pas à manger. Les enfants sont
déshydratés. Bekan says he was part of the first group of 20 that was arrested and expelled across the Libyan border early on Sunday morning before being forced back by armed men. He says now there are over 700 people at the border crossing. They are trapped inside a military zone by the sea without access to fresh drinking water or food, so people are forced to drink seawater. He says there are many babies, children, and pregnant women, some who are close to their delivery date. He says they desperately need help. Although Voice of America has seen a number of videos purportedly filmed by migrants which show pregnant women, children and injured people, Voice of America could not verify his claims. Those trapped in a no-man's land are enduring temperatures of over 46 degrees centigrade, with no water and constant threats of violence. Last month, a delegation from the European Union visited President Saied with an offer of a $1 billion financial package, including an increased budget of $105 million for better maritime border security and migration control. However, Tunisia is still considering their offer. President Saied repeated on Tuesday that Tunisia does not accept to be a guard of any borders except its own. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Elysia Volkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
Kenyan officials say special forces killed 23 Al-Shabaab militants yesterday in clashes that also left 6 troops dead in the country's northeast. Ahmed Hussein reports from Wajir County, Kenya.
Security officials in Kenya say at least 23 Al-Shabaab fighters were killed by Kenyan special forces during the ambush in Orgene village in Mandera County in northeast Kenya. 6 Kenyan soldiers were killed during the encounter, which left 8 others injured. The incident comes just a day after Kenya's security minister Kithure Kindiki vowed to flush militants from Kenyan territories while on a security tour of the country's northeast.
There is an increasing tendency of terrorists to attack our people, including security officers in certain parts of our country. We will sustain the war, we will win the war, and we request for the patience and cooperation of the public.
In the last month, militant groups have killed at least 25 people in a spate of terror attacks near the Kenya-Somalia border. Addressing residents in Wajir, Kindiki said Kenya will use all possible means to eradicate terrorists and their sympathizers from the region.
We're going to upscale our partnership between the security agencies and the local communities to ensure that we flush out this enemy the way our neighbors in Somalia have collaborated between their security agencies and the local communities.
Al-Shabaab operations along the Somalia border in northeastern Kenya have disrupted developments and caused suffering to locals in the 3 counties of Wajir, Garissa and Mandera. Speaking to journalists Friday, Wajir County Governor Ahmed Abdullahi urged locals to help security agencies defeat the militants.
We must work with our security agencies. We must give information. And we must be at the forefront ourselves of fighting Al-Shabaab.
Earlier this year, Kenya announced plans to reopen its border with Somalia that has been closed for over a decade. Those plans have now been changed following the increase in militant attacks. In the past, Islamist Al-Shabaab militants have attacked Kenyan cities and towns, trying to force the withdrawal of Kenyan troops from the African Union-led peacekeeping forces in Somalia. Ahmed Hussein for VOA News, Wajir, Kenya.
Kenyan police fired tear gas into crowds of opposition supporters today as they marched into Nairobi's main business district and in other towns to protest tax hikes. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called the protests to oppose tax increases that have been imposed at a time when many are already struggling with high prices of basic commodities. Kenya's High Court ordered that the tax increases be suspended, but the government has raised fuel prices anyway, leading to a further court challenge. Police were out in force for the protests, the latest called by Odinga this year over the policies of the government of President William Ruto, who defeated Odinga in last year's election. Human rights group Amnesty International, Kenya's office, said police arrested several protesters in the capital and in western Kenya. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Gunmen from Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, have been accused of attacking a remote town today before going on a shooting and looting rampage that witnesses said terrorized its people. A witness told the French news agency AFP that the RSF was looting banks and public buildings in Bara, 350 kilometers south of Khartoum. He said the army was nowhere to be seen. For nearly 3 months, the RSF has fought the National Army in a war that has claimed the lives of at least 3,000 people and displaced millions. Ethnic divisions, clan mentality, paramilitary force formations have now become familiar facades in the everyday lives of citizens in the African continent. In a conversation I had with senior professorial lecturer and chair at the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University, Professor Kawaku Nuwama, he starts by answering my first question in Somalia's, is Somalia's clan system undermining democracy?
I think the clan system as it's currently constituted is not helping the cause of democracy. But the main reason why the clans are playing such an important role is because the state has failed in Somalia. And when the state fails, that people have to migrate towards other centers where their need will be met. And so it is not the clan's job to promote democracy in Somalia. It's the state's job to get its act together, give people a reason to support it rather than their clans. And then the state can help grow democracy by engaging civil society and international partners and building institutions and doing the things that the constitution enables it to do. The state is unique in all of our societies, but when it fails, life must go on and people will go to the next best option.
Professor, what you're talking about, characteristic of only Somalia, but is it also seen in parts of Africa elsewhere as well?
Absolutely. In societies where the state is fragile, you have competing centers of authority. As the state ceases to be an effective manager of the economy, different actors emerge. In some places, a lot of African countries, the state cannot even deliver justice. People have to go to self-help measures. They have to rely on, you know, other actors to give them justice, to provide public services, to give them a sense of identity. Well, you've seen cases in Ethiopia, for example, where people feel the state is not delivering equitably to them. We've seen various places. You can see Nigeria, for example, some parts, depending on where you are, you don't think that the state is doing right by you. Same in Ghana. There are parts of Ghana where people feel very aggrieved. But if you go to eastern part of Ghana along the border with Togo, there's a secessionist movement over there. If you go to the upper regions of Ghana, on a border in Burkina Faso, there's creeping insecurity as people feel that the government far away in Accra is not speaking to their needs. If you go to the DRC, the same thing. That people, if you're in the Kivus, the state doesn't quite reach where you are. And people then have to make do with what is available locally. And sometimes they don't have a choice. And so that's the problem. It's up to the state to give people a reason to be loyal to it alone. The state has unique qualities that other groups shouldn't have. For example, the state should have an absolute monopoly over the means of coercion and the delivery of justice. We don't want to live in a state where I have to go to my local chief to get justice for me or to provide security because I can't trust the government's police officers to do that. Then we get into dangerous territory. You want the government to be strong enough to do all of that stuff. The same way for everybody across the board. Otherwise, you're going to have conflict all over the country.
And lastly, Professor, these paramilitary forces, the one that is happening in Sudan, whereby there is the national army and then there's this paramilitary force. Are those offshoots of this kind of clan mentality where there is no allegiance to the state?
In the case of Sudan, it is actually the government that created the paramilitary force. It's part of the patronage politics of African societies for people in power. They themselves are not really, really 100% waving the national flag. Most of the time, they're waving an ethnic flag. So the people that support them, the people that they trust the most are people from their ethnic groups. And because you have this patronage system in place, those people get to be the ones who protect the president. So you have these ethnic armies, private armies, emerging usually around the presidency in a situation where the legitimacy is always questionable. You're going to have situations like that. You see what's happened with Wagner in Russia, where Putin essentially created this private mercenary group with his friend. And we've seen the conflict that has emerged between Wagner and the regular Russian army. Those kinds of things, they never really end well. You want a situation where security sector reform happen smoothly, where there's only one voice, there's only one chain of command in the country. Otherwise, you're going to have these split loyalties and you're going to always end up with a conflict.
That was Professor Kwaku Nuama, the senior professor, lecturer, and chair of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Given the legacy of slavery and discrimination in the United States, race-conscious admissions have shaped up U.S. higher education since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. However, in one of the final rulings of its current term, the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the use of race as a factor in college admissions, overturning decades of precedent. Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter program, interviewed Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, L.C. Bodie, and legal fellow and manager of the Supreme Court and Appellate Advocacy Program at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, Zach Smith. They differed over the landmark decision, including the ramifications for opportunity and diversity on college campuses and in the workplace across the United States.
So let's start with the pros and cons of the decision from our guests. Zach Smith, let me begin with you. May I assume that you are in favor of the ruling?
I am. I think it's an encouraging ruling. I think it gets back to the roots of what our Constitution, particularly in light of the 14th Amendment, is intended to be. It's a colorblind Constitution. And so this idea that somehow you can have good discrimination is just utterly absurd. I think it didn't have a good precedent in our law. And so I'm very encouraged to see that the Supreme Court stepped back and reaffirmed those basic principles, which I thought we had all agreed on so long ago, that everyone, regardless of their skin color or race or ethnicity, should all be treated equally under the law.
Let me now turn to Professor Elise Bodie. Professor Bodie, I assume you are against this decision, and I would like your reaction to it in response to Zach Smith's reference to the so-called colorblind Constitution and the 14th Amendment.
Sure. Thank you for having me. So not surprisingly, I disagree very strongly with Mr. Smith. And I think Justice Jackson said it all. Our country has never been colorblind. The purpose of the 14th Amendment, in fact, was to remedy discrimination against Black Americans. And what we've seen throughout our country's history is systematic disadvantage that is heaped upon Black Americans and other people of color. And so in order for us to get past that very damaging period of our history that continues into the present, it's important for us to create opportunities for all people to attend institutions of higher education and also to learn from each other in the course of participating in classrooms and participating in extracurricular activities in a university environment. So I think the decision was highly unfortunate and a significant step back for our country.
That was Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, L.C. Bodie, and legal fellow and manager of the Supreme Court and Appellate Advocacy Program at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, Zach Smith. They spoke with Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter program. For more from the show, listen this Saturday and Sunday on Encounter on The Voice of America. Apartheid ended in South Africa 3 decades ago, but Black people still struggle to enter luxury sports like hot air ballooning. 44-year-old Komen Harold Tijane is in the process of busting through that ceiling, training to become the country's first Black hot air balloon pilot. Zahir Kasim reports from Johannesburg.
In the cold and darkness, Komen Harold Tijane gets ready for a day's work of soaring through the skies. It's been over 20 years in the making, but with the help of the ballooning community, Tijane is breaking South Africa's color barrier for hot air balloon pilots.
When I came to ballooning, I was intrigued by the magic of flying. At first, seeing the magic of flying, I never realized that hot air can just raise up things and lift the heavy loads of people in it. And then I was intrigued by all that chemistry. And then it made me feel happy to see people so happy. And then I wanted to be part of the people who make people happy, because I feel like if there's happiness in the world, I mean, the world is a better place to live.
To become a commercial hot air balloon pilot, one must obtain a license and accumulate 100 hours of flying time. Tijane has passed all his exams and accumulated 40 hours in the air. After he completes his remaining 60 hours, he will be able to get a commercial license and get paid to take people up in the sky. The cost of accumulating hours is one of the main barriers to getting a license, explains Richard Bovell, chairman of the Balloon and Airship Federation of South Africa.
The biggest cost is obviously the balloon hire and the gas. Unfortunately, gas is linked to the petrol price. So as we all know, that goes up and down prolifically. So, yes, it is an expensive hobby. And that's it. Then, as I said earlier on, there are all the exams that one has to do. There's medical exams, etc., that the student pilots have to go through.
Tijani's journey towards obtaining his license was made possible through the support of the Federation and the ballooning community. They provided him with a balloon to accumulate flying hours and assisted him in securing government funding for his license. Fellow pilot Mark Nuttall believes that Tijani's patience and resilience have prepared him to be an exceptional pilot.
You certainly get to read all the weather conditions. You get your equipment, you get your crew, you make sure everything's in place. And then you take off and then, okay, what now? You know, conditions are not quite what the Met gave us. Now you've got to deal with it. It's like life itself. You've got to accept those challenges and do it with a smile on your face.
As the morning unfolds, Tijani gracefully ascends into the sky, realizing his dream and elevating the aspirations of South Africans from all walks of life. Zahir Kasim for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent United Nations Security Council briefing on the Democratic Republic of the Congo, UN Assistant Secretary General for Africa Martha Pobee warned that the security situation in the DRC has deteriorated. In the last months alone, hundreds of people have been killed by armed groups. Ms. Pobee said MONUSCO, the UN peacekeeping force, continues to do everything possible to fulfill its mandate to protect civilians. MONUSCO has been in the DRC since 1999, and its mandate was renewed for a year last December with the goal of the force's eventual withdrawal from the DRC. In recent months, however, the DRC government has increased calls for MONUSCO to withdraw from the country after the elections planned for December 2023. U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the UN, Robert Wood, expressed concern over those calls.
MONUSCO cannot and should not stay in the DRC indefinitely. But there is broad consensus that the DRC government will have not met the benchmarks it agreed upon as the minimum conditions for MONUSCO's drawdown by the end of 2023. A precipitous withdrawal of MONUSCO would likely leave a security vacuum that state authorities are unable to fill, with devastating effects for the region's most vulnerable populations.
The humanitarian crisis, Ambassador Wood noted, is also worsening due to continued violence, resulting in 1 million internally displaced persons, an appalling escalation in gender-based violence, including conflict-related sexual violence, and immense human suffering.
To address such a pressing and urgent situation, the DRC and Great Lakes region need political will, a commitment to dialogue, and a willingness to make hard decisions and pursue much-needed reform. They also need MONUSCO.
Ambassador Wood emphasized that the United States is committed to ensuring MONUSCO can deliver on its mandate to protect civilians and assist the DRC strengthen key governance, justice, and security institutions. In order for the mission to succeed, it deserves this Council's support and that of the DRC government. The people of the DRC deserve peace, said Ambassador Wood. The United States stands with them in their pursuit of a better future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.